From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, movement in Congress on guns, North Korea and its missiles, the Obama budget, and a possible deal on immigration. Sandy Hook parents and Senators Joe Manchin, Democrat, and Pat Toomey, Republican, led the way past a filibuster on gun reform. Here's Manchin.
This is common sense. This is gun sense. We're not infringing on the rights of an individual citizen, but basically if you're going to go to a gun show, you should be subjected the same as if you went to the gun store.
A bipartisan stirring now on immigration reform and high hopes at a big rally on the lawn outside the Capitol.
This time is different. We are different. Washington is different. Now is truly the time for immigration reform.
And more heat out of Korea. Missile tests coming. U.S. intelligence pointing to North Korean advances. Secretary of State John Kerry in South Korea said no.
Neither the United States, nor the Republic of Korea, nor the international community. We are all united in the fact that North Korea will not be accepted as a nuclear power.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with Major Garrett of CBS, Jonathan Chait of New York Magazine, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join us on air or online. What do you see coming on guns, immigration, the budget, the Korean Peninsula? Join us anytime digitally at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. This conversation never ends. Joining us from Washington is Major Garrett, Chief White House Correspondent for CBS News and Correspondent at Large for the National Journal. Major Garrett, welcome back to On Point.
Great to be with you, Tom.
Also with us from Washington is Jonathan Chait, staff writer for New York Magazine. Jonathan, welcome back to you as well.
Thank you.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Major, and Jonathan.
Major Garrett, let me come first to you. Everybody at this point has seen the images of North Korean missile launchers out there on hilltops and elsewhere. We're told a missile launch, a missile test could come any time. John Kerry saying to them out of South Korea today, don't do it. If they fire off missiles, what's going to happen? We've got all kinds of U.S. arms around there now. Are we going to shoot them down, let them go? What's the word, Major?
Well, the most important thing the administration wants to do is not to be confused or have any of our allies in the region confused by this missile launch, which is expected and which the White House has tried to sort of pre-telegraph for the better part of a week in order to minimize an overreaction. Now, the one key thing the United States does not know about North Korea's intentions with these missile launches is number and general direction, and both are more than mildly important to the U.S. and South Korean reaction.
Sure.
Here's what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
If there are many of them and they are directed in a way to be sort of threatening and menacing in their early flight path toward U.S. assets in the Pacific, or certainly something that the South Koreans would consider important, that might forcibly provoke a U.S. response. Shoot them down, do something else. The administration doesn't want to go down that road. That's why it's encouraging in every way possible and now urging the Chinese to use whatever financial means they can, which are many, to discourage the North Koreans from making this launch, because things can get confused, they can get muddled, they can get misinterpreted. And with all of the bombastic rhetoric that is already in existence, everyone is tense, more so than they typically are, even though there is a somewhat familiar pattern to this. So the number of missiles fired and their general direction will be key to creating a moderate U.S. response, which is exactly what the administration wants to do. Not overreact, not do anything to create more of a tempest here than there already is.
Moderate, but what does sort of threatening mean as opposed to threatening? With all this rhetoric out there, typically North Korea, it has in the past, had missile tests where the missiles flew over Japan and landed
right
in the sea on the other. Will Japan accept that? Will the U.S. accept that this time with the Japan as a longtime ally?
What is acceptable now has been redefined, in part because the North Koreans have been so obviously and intentionally, and to the eyes of South Korea and Japan, maliciously provocative. And so things that might have been acceptable before may not be now. That's why the administration is trying to discourage this launch in the first place. They don't think they're going to be successful. Senior White House officials told me all week, look, we expect these missile launches to happen. We can, meaning the United States, in coordination with the South Koreans and the Japanese, get a very early and very accurate read on missile flight trajectories and likely landing points. So we can know with a high degree of confidence where they're heading almost as soon as they're fired. Even so, there's more volatility, there's more tension in this. the hope is that if they're fired at all, they'll be on a trajectory that is, and these are mid-range missiles we're talking about. The Musadan missile is a mid-range missile, and that its trajectory will be somewhere in the Pacific and harmlessly enough so as to not provoke or necessitate something from the South Koreans or Japanese that could spin out of control.
Jonathan Chait, you've been watching this for a long time. We're trying to put things together here. We heard the tape there of Secretary of State Kerry in Seoul, South Korea, saying North Korea will not be accepted as a nuclear power. And I'm sure a lot of people are trying to figure out how to square that with what we heard this week. I've got tape here from Thursday. This was the House Armed Services Committee hearing. Republican Colorado Congressman Doug Lamborn reading from accidentally unclassified material, declassified, I guess, much to the surprise of Secretary Hagel, Defense Secretary, and Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, General Martin E. Dempsey, who were testifying at the hearing, talking here about North Korean missile and nuclear weapons capability. Here's the congressman.
This is unclassified, so I can make it public. DIA assesses with moderate confidence the North currently has nuclear weapons capable of delivery by ballistic missiles. However, the reliability will be low.
Jonathan Chait, how do we square these? DIA, Defense Intelligence Agency, the Pentagon's intelligence arm, saying they say with moderate confidence they have nuclear weapons small enough to go on their missiles, and then here's John Kerry saying will not be accepted as nuclear power. Do those square, Jonathan?
Well, probably not, but it's a way of handling the tension between, number one, our strong desire to prevent North Korea from becoming a nuclear menace, and number two, our limited means in achieving that goal. So they're just performing a careful dance.
But Jack, it can start to sound like La La Land, you know, when on the one hand you got Pentagon intelligence saying they've got them, they can do it. Not sure, but it looks like they can. On the other hand, Secretary of State Kerry saying what we've heard for years out of Washington, you know, does the rhetoric work as a containing envelope here when the counter evidence is on the table from U.S. intelligence?
It's hard to see it, although David Sanger in today's Times points out that the DIA, which made this assessment, was the got the Iraq war wildly wrong. They were, recall, that was Richard Pearl and company on mm-hmm. that board then, and they were saying, oh, weapons of mass destruction, they're there, all the rest. So their track record, at least in the last administration, wasn't so good on prescience. You know, what I'm struck with here is that the secretary says said today, the greatest danger here is a mistake. Indeed, it is a miscalculation. And, you know, when you wonder, yes, the North Koreans have certainly been provocative, but you have to wonder, have we been unduly provocative as well? For example, Blaine Hardin, the author of a book on North Korea, and I think he's working on another one, pointed out over the weekend that 85% of the housing stock north of the 38th parallel was destroyed by U.S. bombing during the Korean War, and in North Korea's propaganda-induced memory, Hardin said, that destruction happened yesterday. So sending over the B-2 bombers to the south, as we did a couple of weeks ago, really was on the one hand, a propaganda boon for Kim in the North, and two, it pressed that fear button that they have ever at the ready. And I'm not saying we provoke this, but I am saying that if the greatest danger is a mistake, you want to watch very carefully how you respond to perceived North Korean provocation.
On the other hand, we've got allies all around North Korea who, you know, by treaty and deep reality, depend on the U.S. for defense. They want to know. Elaine in Omaha, Nebraska is calling. Elaine, thanks. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I hear a lot of talk about the threat from North Korea, but I don't hear anything about why they feel threatened and what it is they want from us. So I'd just like to have somebody answer that question.
Major Garrett, what do you say?
Well, what the North Koreans typically want and what they have negotiated for in the past is a combination of Western loans, lifting of economic sanctions imposed by the United Nations, not unilaterally by the United States. So the Security Council has approved them. Just another round imposed after the ballistic missile test the North Koreans carried out in December. So they want food, they want Western loans, and they want a lifting of the sanctions. And none of those are on the table as long as this rhetoric and activity from the North Koreans continues. And that's not just the United States position, that's China's position, that's Russia's position. Tom, give me just 30 or 45
yes,
seconds
please.
To unpack this intelligence thing.
Mm-hmm.
All right, the DIA is one component of a larger intelligence community in the United States. It is one assessment. It is not a unified assessment. Sometimes you remember with the Iraq War and Afghanistan and other things, we have the National Intelligence Estimate, the NIE.
Yep.
That is a coordinated consensus opinion across all intelligence branches. We don't have that here. We have one agency, the Defense Intelligence Agency, DIA, saying two things. They have ballistic missiles and they have nuclear weapons. Nobody disputes that. The key question, and it's not resolvable right now, meaning it's not knowable, is has North Korea miniaturized that nuclear weapon, put it on a ballistic missile, and found a way to put that ballistic missile in orbit and bring it back down to the United, back down to Earth accurately? Now, we have no doubt that they intend to do that and would like to acquire those capabilities. That's why you heard at the beginning and the end of that DIA assessment, moderate confidence, probability low. They are placing
reliability low.
So they're putting caveats on both sides of what is essentially, yes, they have ballistic missiles, yes, they have a nuclear weapon. Have they miniaturized it? Can they fly it? Can they accurately hit
anything? They said it has nuclear weapons capable of delivery. Now, that doesn't go to accuracy, but it does go to delivery. It does go to they can get them up there. At least, but as you say, that's one thread here. But what a hot thread when you've got all this rhetoric flying around. It's got people's attention this week. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Looking at a week in the news, North Korea and its missiles, movement on guns, budget talk, and maybe an immigration deal in the works. Jonathan Chait is with us from New York Magazine, Major Garrett from CBS and National Journal. Jack Beatty's here. Let's go to guns. It was an interesting and emotional week, emotional with Newtown, Sandy Hook parents in Washington lobbying all over the place, with the First Lady Michelle Obama in Chicago at Harper High School, talking there about 15-year-old Hadiyah Pendleton, who, of course, was at the president's inauguration and then, just days later, shot and killed. Here's the First Lady.
Hadiyah Pendleton was me, and I was her, but I got to grow up.
And movement on, everybody thought there would be a filibuster right off the bat on guns. No, not so far anyway. Here's Pennsylvania Republican Senator Pat Toomey. Said the future of his bipartisan amendment with West Virginia Democrat Joe Manchin to expand criminal background checks still up in the air.
We will be able to get started on the underlying bill with the vote today, but how the amendments play out, I think it's just too early to know.
And opponents of movement here, very loud as well. Republican Senator Mike Lee of Utah, one of the organizers of a filibuster against gun control legislation, argued more debate was needed before they should go ahead at all.
We should not be legislating by negotiating closed-door, backroom deals away from the eyes of the American people. We should not be voting before we read and understand exactly how these proposals will affect the rights of law-abiding citizens, and whether we can say with any level of certainty that they will, in fact, reduce crime.
Jonathan Chait, a lot of very moving presence of parents who lost children at Sandy Hook, and no filibuster this week. But where do you see the gun debate standing now? What's the road ahead here, Jonathan?
Well, it's not going to go very far. Look, the whole concept has really been whittled down to one pretty small piece of it, which is background checks. And even within this small piece, background checks, that can also be whittled down to a point where you can start to debate whether it's going to do anything at all. We passed an assault weapons ban in 1994 that was weakened to the point where it probably did little to nothing. You could sort of debate whether it was little or nothing. And I think that's kind of where we are with guns. They're just the obstacles just fundamentally haven't changed that much since Sandy Hook. It was a gripping and powerful tragedy, but I don't really think it changed the complexion of the gun debate.
But the filibuster hasn't happened this week.
Right.
Now, is that just a kind of sidestepping that ball of emotion that came out of the presence of those parents? The Republicans don't want to get in the way of that. So is this rope-a-dope?
I think it's exactly right. I think the optics of filibustering while the Sandy Hook families were in the Senate gallery watching was something the Republican Party chose not to do. And I think they were smart to avoid that trap. But any bill that passes has to go through the House. The House doesn't have to vote on it at all. If they do vote on it, they could just say, well, we'll pass our own bill through the Judiciary Committee. Then they can just pass a nothing bill and just quietly snuff this thing out. But the fundamentals remain that the biggest and most important point here is that rural America is overrepresented in Congress. It's overrepresented in the House, and it's more overrepresented in the Senate. And those are the areas that are most strongly pro-gun. The second most important point is that most people don't really know what the specifics are. That yes, 90% of Americans favor background checks, but a majority doesn't necessarily favor any stronger gun control law because they don't know that background checks aren't already legal. So there's not enough knowledge of the details of this bill to really power public opinion to do anything to change the fundamentals in Congress. And I don't really see that changing.
Major Garrett, you cover the White House. How's the Obama administration? How's the Vice President, Joe Biden, who was sort of tasked to this front? How are they watching what's going on here? Do they see progress? Or is this sort of lining up for a slow death, as Jonathan suggests?
Well, I reported on CBS when the president was in Connecticut Monday that the White House had a sense that it had substantially lost momentum, that it thought it had in the immediate aftermath of the Sandy Hook massacre, that the assault weapons ban had no chance of passing the United States Senate, nor did an attempt to federally limit the size of magazine clips for firearms. Mm. Those were two early goals of the administration. Then it began to get the sense that it might lose any effort to create an expanded roster of information for background checks on future firearm sales. And so then had to find and encourage, in whatever direction it could, some means by which to at least preserve that component of the big three ideas the president laid before Congress. And it had to rely on some unlikely allies, Pat Toomey, a Republican from Pennsylvania, mm-hmm. and Joe Manchin from West Virginia. Joe Manchin is not necessarily considered within the White House a huge ally or reliable vote for the president's agenda. Pat Toomey once ran the Club for Growth, a very hardcore, conservative, fiscally oriented wing of the Republican
Party. And these
guys
both have A ratings, perfect ratings from the NRA.
And that's why they were able to put this together. And by eliminating the thing that those in the gun rights community thought was most objectionable about so-called universal background checks, that is to say, family-to-family, friend-to-friend transaction, and putting most of the legislative attention on gun shows and internet sales, they could live with that. Now, the NRA still opposes this. It's worth pointing out. The gun lobby does not like this amendment, watered down though it is. And it's all the White House believes now it can extract from the Senate. The Sandy Hook families also said this is a legislative compromise. We're willing to take whatever we can get now. And I think the bigger question, and I don't really know the answer, is whatever happens in the House, whatever happens with this particular debate, is this president and is this White House, and will Democrats continue to invest in this debate and run it out for many, many years? Because if you really do want to change the conversation in this country, as is true with many other difficult legislative matters, it can't be one and done. You have to be persistent advocates. And I don't know if the White House will be.
Jack, this whole issue was in a coma for such a long time, just moribund. It came to life after the tragedy in Newtown. What do you see happening right now, Jack?
Well, I think in the short run, the grave danger is this unlimited amendment, the open amendment process. The Times points out today that one amendment, a priority for the NRA, would require states to honor concealed carry laws in other states. So someone from Florida, where they can have concealed carry, could take the gun to New York, and New York couldn't say anything about that. That particular measure got no less than 58 votes in the Senate just a couple of years ago. That's if that happens. If that is included in the bill that even includes background checks, that will kill it. That'll be a poison pill. The liberals can't vote for that. There's another amendment they point out that I just couldn't believe my eyes. But again, it's sponsored by Senator Graham of South Carolina, and it would allow people who've been involuntarily committed to mental institutions, quote, to own guns. I just don't believe that I read that. But this this is an example of the kind of thing we're going to see. You may get 51 or 52 votes, which is all you need for background checks. The question is, will there also be poison pill amendments that will just be irresistible for enough red state Democrats to vote for it? And meanwhile, of course, I only see, perhaps my colleagues can correct me, but I'm aware of only two Republicans, Mark Kirk of Illinois and Senator Toomey of Pennsylvania, who've come out for universal background checks.
We've got people writing in here aplenty. Judy says, all politicians who oppose sensible gun safety regulations should be denied the label pro-life. They believe the right to kill supersedes the right to live. Ask any parent in Newtown. Jack, are there enough Democrats to put this over? As you indicate, you've got Democrats resisting here as well.
You do, and, you know, the Times today has a Democrat saying, you know, from Heidi Heitkamp from North Dakota saying, well, you know, I voted to go ahead with the debate. I'm not going to vote for the bill. This is a way of life in North Dakota. Similarly, Max Baucus also, he's running in 2014 from Montana. He will not vote for the bill. Mark Pryor, Mark Begich. So you're having defections among the Democrats. They're going to have some Republican votes. And as I say, there are only two so far.
Ron in Rensselaer Falls, New York. Ron, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Don.
Hi.
Yeah, my concern with the registration is this, that the registration is, or the background checks, is only as good as the information in it. Mr. Cho in Virginia Tech was able to legally buy a gun because the background check was not given information. He had previously stalked two females at Virginia Tech and should have been arrested or put on his record, plus other considerations. But on the flip side of that, we have here in New York, where a man had his guns taken by New York State because at one time he had antidepressants. And it really opens up a can of worms with HIPAA and confidentiality. At what point do you confiscate someone's guns because they look suspicious, because they talk to a doctor about having antidepressants, and almost everybody on the planet gets antidepressants when they have a surgery or operation.
Ron, with those difficulties, where does it leave you? Let's try anyway, or let's back off of registration?
We have the laws in place that we do, but I also do not like this emotion. I feel bad for the Newton family, but Obama and the whole administration is exploiting those children's deaths. For Obama to say, for Michelle to say, oh, I am just like this girl who was killed in Chicago, that's ridiculous.
Why not say that? She grew up there. Why not?
I could say the same thing. My great-grandmother defended herself as a widow with a pistol, and I can say I am my grandmother because she had a gun to protect herself against an intruder that broke through her door.
But when you've got people dying, what should we just cover our eyes and ears and say and ignore it, Ron?
Well, we have people dying from lots of other things, too. It's the emotional argument. More people are killed by hammers and rifles, but let's get those evil assault rifles. And what about the fact that our U.S. government will go to high schools, get naive teenagers, take them to boot camp, teach them to love their gun like their mother and their girlfriend, go out and kill people, they come back with PTSD and say, oh, suddenly you can't have a gun. Guns are bad in schools, but you can go in the government and be taught how to, you know, stab.
Well, of course, that's the army, that's the military, that goes to war. We've got it. People looking here at how do we organize ourselves at home, not on a war front. Major, when the sound and fury is all done, is it clear how this turns out? There clearly, politicians were moved this week by the images of those parents and the memory of that massacre. Does that ebb? Does this move?
Well, look, having covered legislative politics for the better part of 25 years, you have to understand every legislative process has a cycle, and we're at the beginning of this cycle. We've achieved, if you believe that this debate is important, and now the Senate has said it does, a stage where we're going to have a debate, and there will be amendments on the floor, and there will be a political process in which names will be called and votes will be cast in the full light of day. And the country will evaluate not only the votes cast, the words spoken, and the underlying facts of whatever the amendments are. And Ron has brought up some of the points, whether you consider them valid or not, mm-hmm. within the legislative context, they are incredibly valid because people who are writing this compromise wanted to deal with some of those underlying issues. What is mental illness? What is going to be the status of the database? Congress can write a database law, but if it doesn't fund it, it's utterly useless. And he brought up a point about the underlying facts in Virginia Tech. After that, there was a new federal law passed, and there is now much better coordination between the states with their own databases. It's not as good as it ought to be, but there's been more funding, and the Obama administration, as part of this, is going to seek more funding. All of these things have to be evaluated as sort of a fact, non-fact basis, then within a political context, and we're going to begin to see that process in the Senate. And then it will render a judgment. And once that judgment is rendered, it will have a certain amount of political tinsel strength, and it will go to the House. And House Republicans are not committing to anything, but they know if a bill comes to the Senate, I mean from the Senate, with at least some Republican support, it will be a fact they cannot ignore. And then the cycle will begin there.
This cycle is going to roll on. We'll watch it closely. Much more to come there. I want to turn to the budget. Lots going on there this week. President Obama late, but there with a budget and saying he's ready to meet the Republicans more than halfway. Got some pushback from his own party because Social Security and Medicare are in part on the table here. Here's the president on Wednesday presenting his budget for the 2014 fiscal year to Congress.
If anyone thinks I'll finish the job of deficit reduction on the backs of middle-class families or through spending cuts alone that actually hurt our economy short-term, they should think again. When it comes to deficit reduction, I've already met Republicans more than halfway, so in the coming days and weeks, I hope that Republicans will come forward and demonstrate that they're really as serious about the deficits and debt as they claim to be.
The president got pushed back from a couple of directions, some to his left. Even before he came out, Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders joined protesters in front of the White House expressing concern over proposed cuts to Medicare and Social Security.
Tens of millions of workers, seniors, disabled vets who are saying loudly and clearly, we are not going to balance the budget on the backs of the elderly, disabled vets, the sick, the women, or the children.
Vermont's Bernie Sanders, but then just today, House Budget Committee Chairman Paul Ryan, an unlikely positive voice here maybe for the president, talked with NPR's Morning Edition, saying that signs point to the possibility that a budget deal could be reached.
This is the first time in this presidency that I have seen a chance at a bipartisan budget agreement, so I am cautiously optimistic about that.
Jonathan Chait, what do you make of the proposal the president has made here on the budget?
Well, what he's done is formalize the offer that he's made to Republicans previously. Now, you would think that logically this shouldn't really make a difference. What matters is what he's willing to sign. And here's what he said. He wrote up this document saying, here's my offer. Let's make this deal. They wouldn't accept the deal. Now, when he turned this from an offer on the budget into a budget, some people said, well, that makes it different somehow, which I don't really understand. But I suppose conceivably some people might make different decisions. But I don't really think anything has changed. And I don't think Republicans are going to bite on it. Their position is no new revenue, period. No way, no how, no matter what. And, that remains the same.
Jack B., what about the president's pushback from his own party here? He's looking at a new way of calculating Social Security benefits, which would gradually cut people's hikes in their Social Security check down and back. He's looking at changes in Medicare that would amount to cuts. Is there, speaking of tensile strength of politics, what about within the Democratic Party? Is this a breaker or not?
It certainly is creating divisions there. Here's Elizabeth Warren saying she is shocked at it and that he is trying to dismantle Social Security inch by inch. She's not talking about a Republican president. But, if you step back from this and sort of look at it as a question of government priorities, Ron Brunstein in the National Journal today has some interesting and really provocative figures. He points out that as recently as 1969, or not so recent, entitlement spending and investments in the future were each constituted about a third of the budget. Today, entitlements, 65% of the budget, investments, 14%. He quotes the Urban Institute that Washington now spends seven times as much per senior as it does on children, per child. This is not a recipe for future growth.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. In other news this week, beloved original Mouseketeer Annette Funicello died at 70 after a long battle with multiple sclerosis. 10 years back, as she got her own star on Hollywood's Walk of Fame, she told reporters she owed it all to one guy, or mouse, really.
For every important event of my life, Mickey Mouse is always by my side.
Now it's time to say goodbye to all our company.
A spectacular finale to college basketball's March Madness. Louisville men's basketball team beat Michigan in the end, 82-76. Louisville student Patrick Dugan went wild.
It feels so good after 27 years!
Yes, and country star Brad Paisley and rapper LL Cool J teamed up for a new song, Accidental Racist, looking, they said, to promote understanding between white Southerners and African Americans. Critics weren't buying it. They called it the worst song ever, hilarious, and actually just racist.
Yes, I'm a white man.
If you don't judge my do-rag, I won't judge your red flag.
You don't judge my do-rag, I won't judge your red flag. Okay, Major Garrett is with us from CBS, Chief White House Correspondent there, Jonathan Chait from New York Magazine, staff writer there, our own Jack Beatty. Let's go to Joe in Hopkinsville, Kentucky. Hopkinsville, Joe, you're on the air.
Hey, Tom, how are you doing?
Okay.
I just wanted to comment on, I don't understand why the president is even putting forward anything regarding Social Security, given the influence of the Tea Party. This is not the time to be talking about things that are going to have a very negative effect on a lot of people 20 years down the road. I know that his legacy is important to him, and he's wanting to get this out of the way so he might can pass some other things, but I would think he'd be more interested in 2 years getting a Democratic majority in the House so he'd have a chance to pass that. I know it's difficult, but...
Well,
it's beyond me.
Yeah, let us pick it up, Joe. Jonathan Chait, why now? Politically, fiscally, economically, why this move by the president now to say, yes, we can cut back here?
They've been trying for 2 years to do it. Basically, the Republican Party came into office, you know, screaming their heads off about big government, socialism, blah, blah, blah. But the piece of it that Obama felt he could deal with was the deficit, because he thought, I'm concerned about the long-term deficit, too. And mm-hmm. his administration was filled with Clinton veterans who feel the same way. So they sort of said, well, what if we take this complaint at face value and see if we can deal on it? They couldn't deal on it. They couldn't get Republicans to accept anything remotely balanced. They thought that after the election, that would change things, that part of the Republican calculation. In fact, Paul Ryan reportedly said this to Eric Cantor, that if we strike this deal that is before the election, that'll look good for Obama. It'll help him win. We can't do it. Then he thought, okay, now the election's behind us. Now maybe we can actually sit down and make this deal. And he also thinks that if he puts this behind him, number one, it'll help him politically. Number two, it will help him make the case for short-term measures to bring unemployment down, which might increase the deficit in the short run temporarily. And if you've settled this long-term deficit issue, that there's space to do that. But I think for a lot of the same reasons, Republicans have no incentive to come to any agreement like that. So I think we're basically still stuck in the same place.
Is it punishment for seniors if it goes through? I mean, you got Tom Harkin in Iowa saying don't punish seniors. You heard Jack quoting Elizabeth Warren there saying this is dismantling Social Security inch by inch. Is that a fair criticism?
It's not dismantling it. It's a cut. What they've proposed is to change the way that you handle the cost of living adjustment for Social Security. Now, there's an argument that the current measure is too generous, that the cost of living increase is too high. It's a plausible argument. I think you can argue against as well. The net effect of it isn't to dismantle Social Security, though. Even if you think it's wrong and that the current measure is right, you're talking about a 3% cut over a pretty long period of time. So it's not dismantling it. It's a cut. It's a cut that Obama doesn't want, but it's one he thinks he can accept in return for revenue. But he's not going to get the revenue, so I think this is probably never going to happen anyway.
Major Garrett, you quote the Center for Economic and Policy Research saying the average retiree could lose maybe $650 by age 75, $1,100 by age 85. Well, is that manageable for American retirees? I guess they're not all in the same boat, are they, Major?
No, they're not all in the same boat. And these estimates are very hard to know because you don't know what the inflation factor is going to be 7 years from now. And you don't know by what percent this less generous inflation adjustment will be. So it's very, very hard to come up with precise or even near precise estimates of how much this will cost the individual retiree. There are 15 million Americans who receive Social Security benefits currently. and the average Social Security benefit check on a yearly basis is about $15,000. So if you're on a fixed income and your inflation adjustment is less generous, over time, year after year after year, that takes on a compounding negative influence on you. Now, the president is willing to do this because, A, it's been demanded by Republicans. B, he believes it gives him some legitimacy to say he has taken risks and is willing to take risks. And the White House does believe there's a practical difference between sort of proposing it over the phone or in a quiet conversation with Speaker John Boehner and putting it in an actual budget that everyone can look at. They do believe that's sort of upping the ante as far as credibility and visibility on this proposal. Yep. But of course, Democrats say, look, we should not encroach on Social Security at all. Elderly Americans on fixed incomes are stressed enough because their passbook savings or other savings mechanisms, because of very record low interest rates, aren't gaining them anything.
Right. No return.
So, no return. So Social Security is as important, if not more important, to this old matrix of making ends meet for elderly Americans. And they just don't like the principle of a Democratic president going down this road at the request of conservative Republicans, which is exactly what the president's going to do. I do agree that this is unlikely to happen, but the president does believe it creates a space of credibility that perhaps he didn't have before. And I will tell you this, as the fiscal cliff negotiations were in their final hours, the White House kept telling Republicans, look, you're going to give in on taxes. That's a reality. We are going to force you to raise tax rates. And they did. And the White House kept telling Republicans, do this other thing so you can have both some entitlement reforms and tax rates. Because if you don't, all you're going to get is tax rates. And that still sticks in Republican craw and makes them less likely to imagine, let alone vote for, a bigger, grander bargain.
Let's go to Tom in Northbridge, Massachusetts. Tom, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
First of all, I'm 65 years old, mm-hmm. and I want to talk about entitlements. And I want to say, I deliver Meals on Wheels, and I want to say emphatically, yes, it will be a punishment to seniors at the lower end of the economic scale, this cost of living adjustment. It will be a punishment. And what I would like to see happen is raise the age of retirement. When they put this into effect years ago, people were dying a lot earlier. Like maybe raise it 2 years, 2 months a year for 12 months, mm-hmm. And means test it, you know, and do the same with Medicare. Means test it. We've got to do something because it's going to break our country. We can't burden our youth with these high taxes.
Tom, I appreciate your call. Yes, Jonathan.
Can I respond to a couple things? Number one, those are two common proposals. I think a lot of people who suggest these things don't realize, number one, we're already on track to raise the Social Security retirement age. That's in the pipeline to age 67. Number two, both programs, Social Security and Medicare, are already means tested. So you can say we should.
You mean in the sense of the payout?
The payout, right. Mm-hmm. Well, premiums are higher for higher income recipients in Medicare, and you get paid a much higher rate of return if you're low income in Social Security than high income. Now, you could say we should adjust that more, and I agree that any cut needs to protect the lowest income recipients. But I think a lot of people discuss this as if those features aren't already in the programs, and they are.
But maybe there's more required. I mean, what about this dynamic Jack Beatty points out, Jonathan, of the in a way, the country or the Democrats over a barrel here that maybe don't want to cut those benefits. On the other hand, they do want to have money to invest in research, in pre-K education, in lots of things that ought to, in infrastructure, things that should put the country in a better position forward going, or at least that's the idea. Is it one or the other? I mean, is the only way to have those investments, as the president calls them, to hit up these entitlements?
It's not the only way. It's a way. Look, there are a lot of pieces you have to fit together, right? There's you know, retirement programs. There's investment spending. There's defense spending. And there's the tax levels you're willing to tolerate. If we're going to continue to be one of the lowest tax countries in the Western world and have relatively high levels of military spending, and those things are fixed and you assume they can't change, then yes, if you want to invest more, then mathematically your only choice is to take it out of retirement programs. Now, if you say, well, what if we play with those other factors a little bit more, then there's more room for more creative solutions.
Jack, what do you actually see coming here?
Well, I think at least this has happened. I think that the president has it seems to me this is a bold proposal, and he deserves credit for that. He and Pat Toomey, I think, are the politically courageous people of the week. But he's also gifted the Republicans with a very cogent talking point, and John Boehner spoke to it yesterday. Basically, he said, Mr. President, you're saying cutting entitlements is needed to preserve them for the future. We've been saying that for years, so let's go ahead on what we agree on, cutting entitlements, and not hold this desirable step hostage to raising taxes. We're going to hear a lot of that, and it's a very hard one for the president to deal with. If it is desirable to do this for the sake of the programs, to preserve them for the future, can he really say, well, but I will only do it if you give me tax increases? Can he really do that, hold that point when Republicans come to him and say, you know, you've said it's necessary. We agree. Let's do the thing we agree on.
I want to turn to immigration, another front on which it felt like there was movement this week, and we may hear much more about that in the week ahead. The so-called Gang of Eight in the Senate coming up with some kind of consensus, maybe. And just yesterday, Republican South Carolina Senator Lindsey Graham saying the Republican Party has moved, has evolved on immigration.
I think the winds to our back. I think the Republican Party is much more even-keeled about and practical about the 11 million. The key is keeping business and labor together on the guest worker program. But from a Republican Party point of view, I think our self-deportation days are behind us.
Self-deportation days are behind us. That tough line on immigration. Well, maybe. We'll look at what's proposed. Here's Arizona Republican Senator and Gang of Eight member John McCain talking with Fox News about what conservatives need to see, he said, in immigration reform proposals.
For example, there is a poll today that showed the majority of Americans overwhelmingly, including a majority of Republicans, favor a legalization if, and it's a huge if, the people who are here illegally pay back taxes, pay a fine, learn English, and get in the back of the line.
Major Garrett, is this the breakthrough coming maybe next week, or is this a line so long to citizenship that it just changes the rhetoric but not the reality?
Your last question is very, very important in this entire debate. And the details from this legislative proposal will be as important, if not more important, than the details we discussed earlier in the program relating to any new gun control. This is a hugely complex issue. And immigration reform, any immigration piece of legislation, by its very nature, affects individuals with each and every word. Everyone has an immigration circumstance. And writing a law to be compassionate and aware of those particular concerns and those particular grievances is extremely difficult. That's why this Gang of Eight has for now 2 weeks straight reported progress that would culminate in a Friday release of the legislation. And for the second week, that deadline has lapsed. I'm not bearish on this. I do believe they'll produce a piece of legislation, but this is why. The complexity of each and every section of immigration reform, whether it's future flow, guest worker, how you what has been achieved in terms of border security, what you do with migrant workers, so-called migrant workers in the agriculture industries, the numbers, all these things are incredibly complex and very difficult to write. And then once you do write it and agree among yourselves, in the case of the Gang of Eight, then you have to subject it to the entire Senate and to the entire country. And that will be the next stage of this debate. I do think there will be a bill. I think it will be in every way a kind of bill that reflects everyone who has a stakeholding perspective on this debate remaining in the tent, which hasn't occurred since 2007. So that will in itself be a breakthrough. But then it will be subjected to intense policy scrutiny and political heat, and we'll see how much it can withstand.
Jonathan Shade, rhetoric or reality changing here? I mean, if we get something, I mean, there's a bill out there apparently that would there'd be a period of 10 years before Homeland Security, for them to make plans and fortify the border, and they'd have to have very high levels of surveillance, 100% and 90% of enforcement on coming across the border before these other steps towards citizenship could even come into effect with triggers along the way to derail those. So is this real or is this the mirage, Jonathan?
No, I think it's quite real. I think the Republican Party decided after the election, really maybe even before the election, that this was the one thing they had to give on. They couldn't tolerate this anymore. The non-white and especially Latino segments of the electorate are growing too fast. They're turning too fast against the Republican Party, and they just can't tolerate this anymore. They've got to take a dive. And I think that's the entire strategic decision the party's made. And it's just a question of getting from here to there. Now, as Major says, it's complicated, but I think given the big picture that they really have no will to fight this, they need to put on a show for some of their base that they're fighting on the details that some of the activists care about. But they really have no strategic will to fight this, and I think we're going to get there.
And before we go, a voice we may not soon hear again, Margaret Thatcher, dead this week.
Let us resist the blandishments of the faint hearts. Let us ignore the howls and threats of the extremists. Let us stand together and do our duty, and we shall not fail.
Margaret Thatcher in 1980, Jack Beatty, the Iron Lady. How lasting her legacy?
Well, the British say immensely, and even the Labour Party, of course, changed its tune because of Mrs. Thatcher, and I think that was acknowledged this week. On the other hand, I've been struck by the hatred that people have manifested toward her. Elvis Costello, someone was quoting his lyrics from a song, "I'd like to live long enough to savor, that when they finally put you in the ground, I'll stand on your grave and tramp the dirt down." Ooch! But on the other hand, she's going to get practically a state funeral, and there's no doubt she's one of the great characters of modern British history.
Margaret Thatcher with an enormous stamp on decades of history already. We'll see what the future holds on that front. Jack Beatty, always great to have you here. Thank you so much for joining us today, sir.
Thank you.
Major Garrett, White House correspondent for CBS News, correspondent at large with National Journal. Major, thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
And Jonathan Chait, staff writer for New York Magazine, joining us today from Washington. Thank you so much, Jonathan.
Great, thanks.
Listeners, it's great to have you with us. On Monday, we'll look at the CIA's turn from spying to killing. Join us then. Have a good weekend. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.